I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Is there any way for the United States and its European allies to reverse the Russian military occupation of Crimea? Or are President Putin's troops there to stay? Conversation and commentary about the crisis in Ukraine and Crimea this hour with Maryland Senator Ben Cardin, Will England, the Moscow correspondent of The Washington Post, and with Max Hilaire, the political science chair at Morgan State, who keeps a close eye on President Obama's approach to foreign affairs. Our phone lines are open. Should the U.S. and European nations force Putin to pull his troops from the Crimean Peninsula or accept the occupation as a way of keeping Russia from advancing further into Ukraine? We'll get to that question and others after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick in Hagerstown, WYPO Ocean City, and the Eastern Shore of Maryland, streaming live online through WYPR.org. I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks again for making Midday part of your day. As you just heard on the news, we're going to be talking here about the developments in Ukraine and Crimea. The Russian President Vladimir Putin is still denying that he has deployed additional troops to the Autonomous Republic of Crimea in Ukraine. Meanwhile, the powers of the West trying to figure out the best course of action to try to de-escalate what President Obama has suggested may be a violation of international law. The White House has already announced plans to impose economic sanctions on Russia, a move that many European Union countries are somewhat uncomfortable with, as Russia is a major provider of energy to Western Europe. Secretary of State John Kerry already pledging to send $1 billion in aid to the interim Ukrainian government, which is pro-Western, the EU offering 11 billion euros in the next couple of years to the new government in Kiev. Today on Midday, we want to take a look at the crisis in the Ukraine and get your reactions to it here on Midday, an opportunity for our listeners of WYPR to weigh in on this and let us know how you feel about these developments. During the hour, we'll be hearing from Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland. Max Hilaire will be joining us again, chair of the Political Science Department at Morgan State University, who keeps a close eye on President Obama's approach to foreign policy. But up front, we start our show with Will England, foreign correspondent for The Washington Post, who is based in Moscow, has been a longtime correspondent out of Moscow with his wife, Kathy Lally. Will, joining us today. Thank you very much, Will.
It's my pleasure. It's always a pleasure to be in Baltimore, even on the air.
Will had one time worked at the Baltimore Sun, of course, before going to the Washington Post. So, Will, it's hard to know where to begin here. I must say that Crimea was not on our radar much. Ukraine certainly was during the Sochi Olympics and the last few months. Crimea, though, can we talk a little bit about this, just a little bit of the history here? Russia, Ukraine, and Crimea. Has there been a separatist movement in Crimea that you can that we can speak of?
Well, as with everything in Russia, it is a complicated history. I'll just turn back to more than 150 years ago. If any of your listeners remember the poem "The Charge of the Light Brigade," that was about a battle in the Crimean Peninsula between the English and the Russians. The Russians feel like for centuries they've had these heroic defenses of the Crimea against Western invasion. It was the British and French in the 19th century, and it was, of course, the Germans in the 20th century. And so for Russia, Crimea has a real kind of historical significance and importance. And the fact that 20 years ago Ukraine became an independent country, well, that's sort of, you know, they don't think of it as part of Ukraine. They think of it as part of historic Russia, and there's a little justification for that. So it really has a strong appeal to Russians. Now, and the Russians, of course, have a very large naval base on Crimea, and they have a couple of auxiliary bases as well. So there has been a Russian military presence there throughout this whole period, you know, going back to since the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the people in the Crimea don't consider themselves as Ukrainians. They're Russian-speaking, but there was a Russian, kind of a pro-Russian party that in the last elections got 4% of the vote. So that suggests that, you know, people aren't eager to necessarily embrace Russia. The guy who leads that party was installed last week by the Russians as the new prime minister of the Autonomous Republic of Crimea. So, you know, it kind of goes both ways.
Yeah, I asked about separatism only because I wondered in the background to this, in the backdrop to what finally happened here, were people in Crimea begging Russia to break away from Ukraine, to help them break away from Ukraine?
Well, just 4% were. Others were not. There's about a quarter of the population, slightly more than a quarter, are Crimean Tatars, you know, a traditional Muslim group that's been there for 1,000 years at least. They're all Russian-speaking, but they have no interest whatsoever in joining with Russia. They were treated very badly during the Soviet period, and they're very happy to be part of Ukraine. So that's not an inconsiderable minority.
So, Will, I got to ask you about President Putin's press conference yesterday and trying to follow this and decipher what he had to say there. It's not easy to figure out exactly what the maybe a strategic vision would be for Russia sending troops there.
There are plenty of people here. I'm in Moscow at the moment. Here in Russia, I was in Kiev this morning. Mm-hmm. Plenty of people in Ukraine as well, who question whether does Putin actually have a strategic vision. You know, is he this master player, or is he kind of winging it at the moment? No one is really quite sure. If he takes, let's say, certainly Russia has control of Crimea at the moment. And there are many fears among Ukrainians that he's going to try to take control of eastern Ukraine as well, which is a traditional Russian-speaking and kind of Russian-leaning part of the country. You know, if he does that, he's going to have an implacable enemy in the rest of Ukraine, and they're going to run right into the embrace of NATO. And so does he want to do that? You know, probably not. But once he put all his cards on President Viktor Yanukovych, who he didn't care for, but, you know, this was his guy. Yanukovych absconded on February 22nd, and people have pointed out Putin doesn't actually have anybody else to any other card to play, in a sense. You know, he doesn't have any other players in Ukraine to you know, work his will. So he's gone into the Crimea, and you know, maybe he's figuring, well, we'll see what happens.
You know, by saying that Yanukovych is the legitimate leader and was, you know, deposed in a coup, isn't Putin saying that that might be something he insists on, the reinstallation of that president?
That's what Russia has been talking about, although it is very clear that Putin doesn't care much for Yanukovych. And he mentioned yesterday in his press conference, you know, he said, I told Yanukovych he wasn't going to ever get reelected. One foreign policy analyst here in Moscow said Putin sees him as being slippery and unreliable. When Russia says we want to go back to the agreement that was in place just before Yanukovych skedaddled, probably there would be some variation of that agreement that would not include Yanukovych, which would be okay with Moscow. But you know, at the moment, he's the hammer they have, the stick they have to hit Ukraine over the head with.
I just want to ask you about the German chancellor's comments about her phone call the other evening, I think it was Sunday night, with President Putin. Angela Merkel saying that she thought he was in another world, that he was not dealing with reality. You know, I thought that was going some for her to say, make a public statement like that, to characterize the conversation with those words.
That is pretty strong. And when John Kerry was in Kiev yesterday, he didn't use those words exactly, but that certainly the impression that he gave was that, you know, Putin is not talking about what's really happening. I mean, Putin says in his press conference yesterday, he says that the streets of Kiev are being roamed by, you know, masked criminals and terrorists who are terrorizing the population. You know, I've been in Kiev for the last 2 weeks, and it's not true. Life is going on fairly normally in the city. Is he misinformed? Is he making up stories? I don't know.
Here's the question then, I guess, today. Is there any way for the United States and its European allies to reverse, you know, this military presence in Crimea by Russia, if you want to call it occupation? I mean, it's hard to see what the end game is here. It's hard to imagine Putin just pulling out without getting something out of this.
It is. And let me go back to what I was saying earlier. You know, there are this big naval base and sort of ancillary Russian military installations in Crimea. And certainly they're not going to give those up. I mean, those they were existing, and they're still going to be there. I think what the U.S. is hoping for, as I understand it, is that these these men in green, Putin calls them local self-defense people, everybody else calls them Russian soldiers, are pulled back to the bases in Crimea. No, Russia is not going to, you know, evacuate Crimea. No one expects that to happen. But I think the hope in Washington and in other Western European capitals is that it kind of goes back to the way it was. And that what they see as the mechanism for that is this, you know, somewhat sleepy organization that goes back to the Cold War days. It's based in Vienna, and it's called the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the OSCE, which is supposed to, you know, kind of keep an eye and make a forum for consultation on military matters in the areas of Europe that are between Russia and the West, in a sense. And they're hoping they could use the OSCE as a forum, send in delegations, this kind of stuff. And Russia being a member of the OSCE, you know, could take part, and there could be this kind of separation of the forces again. I don't know whether that's likely to happen or not.
Wow. Will England joining us from Moscow, where he's the correspondent for The Washington Post. And now I'd like to bring into the conversation Max Hilaire, who joins us from time to time here on Midday, chairman of the Political Science Department and associate professor at Morgan State University. Max, nice to see you again. Thank you.
Thanks for welcoming me back.
We were just talking about this on Friday, wondering what was going to happen, and now we see what has happened in Crimea. I want to ask you this question, and Will, you can respond as well. Autonomous Republic of Crimea in Ukraine, does that bear into this at all, the fact that it's an autonomous republic? Could this end up being, you know, sort of a separate state? Could Crimea actually be a separate state?
Well, not necessarily a separate state, although that could be worked out within the constitution of Ukraine. So you could have a referendum that is sanctioned by the government of Ukraine, and if the Crimean population decides to go it their separate way and become an independent country, I think that's a right granted to all peoples under international law. Whether they get recognized by the rest of the international community except Russia is something else.
I
and
see.
We see the same in Georgia with Abkhazia, South Ossetia. Only Russia and probably Venezuela and Nicaragua have recognized these two republics as independent states, but no one else. Hmm. So it's possible Russia could do so.
I bring it up just wondering, you know, what the meaning of autonomous republic in this context means, and without even knowing whether this is something Vladimir Putin would want.
Well, they currently enjoy some degree of autonomy, but the central government in Ukraine is responsible for security and foreign affairs. So outside of Ukraine, they're not recognized as anything else. I mean, it's not very different from the tribal, the reservations in the United States or the tribal nations.
Right.
They have some degree of autonomy within the United States, but externally, they're not recognized as independent.
Will?
Dan, if I could just jump in, yeah. I would just point out that from Putin's point of view, you know, it's sort of better to have a whole lot of pro-Russian people living in Ukraine and still voting in Ukraine than it would be to take them away from Ukraine, because you're then leaving behind a much more anti-Russian country.
Ah, okay. Well, Will, so how do we pressure? I mean, I don't know what happens next. We're going to ask Senator Cardin about it in a minute here. The answer that you laid out to my question sounds pretty good, but it calls for lots of diplomacy and rational thinking, right?
It does, yes.
Yeah. Well, listen, Will, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Yep. He was just in Kiev this morning, now speaking to us from Moscow. That's Will England, correspondent of the Washington Post based there. Max Hilaire from Morgan State is going to stay with us for the hour. Senator Ben Cardin's coming right up after this break on Midday. And we'd like to hear from you. We have open phone lines this hour. Please weigh in. Tell us what you think of the situation and President Obama's handling of it and Secretary of State Kerry. 410-662-8780 is our local number, toll-free long distance, 866-661-9309. And the Midday email address, midday@wypr.org.
If, in fact, they continue on the current trajectory that they're on, that we are examining a whole series of steps, economic, diplomatic, that will isolate Russia and will have a negative impact on Russia's economy and its status in the world.
President Obama speaking about the Russian military action in Crimea and on the Crimean Peninsula of Ukraine. 410-662-8780. Dan Roderick's here with Max Hilaire from the Political Science Department at Morgan State University. Now joined by Senator Ben Cardin, who's giving us some time today to talk about this crisis in Crimea. Senator Cardin, thank you for being on the show today.
Dan, it's always a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm wondering what you've been thinking the last few days as this has played out. What are your thoughts on what Russian President Putin has done here?
Well, first, it's extremely dangerous, and it is of great concern not just to Ukraine, not just to that region, but it's a global issue. And let me explain why. This is the second time that Russia has done this. They did it in Georgia, and as you know, that circumstance is still not resolved. Here, they are violating their international commitments that they've made in the organizations that they belong to. This is a forceful takeover of an independent country, part of an independent country, and it clearly there's no justification. They say they're trying to protect Russian ethnics that are in that part of Crimea. But in reality, there's a mechanism to make sure that all people are protected, and Ukraine has agreed to allow OSCE observers to be there to make sure that all people's rights are respected. So this is just a sheer grab of territory by Russia. Now, why I say it's so dangerous, I had a hearing yesterday on my East Asia and Pacific subcommittee, and China in the South China Sea came up, and there's territorial disputes about islands that could mushroom into all-out conflict. China is watching very carefully how the international community responds to what's happening in Crimea. And if there's not an adequate response, China's options in the South China Sea could be different. And the list goes on and on and on. It is absolutely essential that the international community work together to isolate Russia if they continue down this path. One thing we don't want to do is do things that could provoke violence. We saw that in Georgia, that was not productive. We want to make sure that there is no justification for violence in that region. There are ways that we can use the tools we have available to make Russia pay a very heavy price, and we think it will have the best chance to have them change their ways.
Do you think the U.S. and its European allies would have to accept, say, Russian occupation indefinite of the Crimean Peninsula in order to keep Russia from advancing further, causing more trouble in Ukraine?
I think that the Europe and the United States must provide the leadership to have Russia pay a very heavy price if they keep their troops outside of the designated areas in Crimea. There's ways in which Russia can back off of this. They claim they're not interested in annexing Crimea. If that's indeed their intentions, there's ways to making sure that they're protected in regards to their military facility and their Russian ethnics. There's a way that they can back off of this confrontation. That's what we're looking for to have them do. It's not to contain them and say they can have the Crimea. No, we will not accept that.
Senator, I'm here with Max Hilliard from Morgan State. Max, go right ahead.
Senator, good afternoon. Good to talk to you. I wanted to ask, given your leadership on the human rights situation in Russia, of course, you co-sponsored the Magnitsky Act, which I think was a very good message to the Russians that we would not tolerate the disregard of human rights, their human rights obligations. Is there anything the Senate can do in terms of boosting up the president's authority at this point, whether it's a joint resolution or some symbolic action taken, or would you sponsor a resolution, a bill in the Senate to targeted sanctions on members of the Russian army or even President Putin himself?
I think the Senate and the Congress is prepared to act to give whatever tools are needed to carry out an isolation of Russia if they continue down this path. We want to work, though, in unison. We want to work in unison in Congress so there's no division. We want to work very closely with the administration. A lot of they can do with their own administrative powers, but if they need additional help, then we want to make sure they have that. And we want to work closely with Europe so that there is unity in the approach that we take. But I think it's very clear that the Congress is prepared not just to pass a resolution, but to pass legislation to give adequate tools to impose this the most difficult isolation of Russia if they continue down this path.
And Senator, I wanted to follow up a second question I wanted to ask in regards to violation of international law. We know very well the Bush administration invaded Iraq without provocation, without authorization from the Security Council, and a clear breach of our obligations under the United Nations Charter. Is that a precedent that we've said that Russia could now emulate to justify its actions in Ukraine? And what moral authority do we have to condemn Russia when in the past we've taken similar actions in violation of international law?
No, I don't think that's a fair comparison. Understand that I voted against the authorization for force in Iraq. I did not believe that the United States should have used force. Also understand that that was a part of justifications that to contain international terrorism. There was a strong consultation with the United Nations before any action was taken. It was not taken by the United States alone. It was taken with other colleagues, and it was dealing with an immediate threat. Again, although I disagreed with the decision that was made, I don't think it is comparable to a country without any provocation. Here, Russia is moving forward. There is no evidence that the Russian ethnic population in Crimea is under any risk. Even if they were, there are international organizations that can provide the protection and are prepared to do it, including the OSCE. And here, Russia is clearly responding to its own agenda, not any outside or external threat. So I don't think it's a fair example, and I think it is a clear violation. The United States also was not seeking territory. None of the countries involved in that were seeking territorial control. They were seeking to deal with a threat to their own country. Here in Crimea, there is no threat. Here, Russia is clearly trying to exercise territorial control.
Senator Cardin, I want you to hear the comments of one of your colleagues in the Senate from the other side, John McCain, what he had to say about this situation and President Obama's role in it.
The President of the United States believes that the Cold War is over. That's fine. It is over. But Putin doesn't believe it's over. He doesn't believe that that this is a zero-sum game. Look at Moldova. Look at the occupation of Georgia. Look at the pressure on the Baltic nations. Look at what they're doing in assisting Bashar Assad slaughter tens of thousands of innocent people in cities and towns and countryside all over Syria. It is an outrage.
Okay, so what's the outrage? What does Senator McCain suggest the President of the United States and we as a country do in this regard? That would be my next question. I understand everything that he's laying out there. But is he saying there's something we should have done, haven't done up to this point, in order to contain Putin, Senator Cardin?
Well, Senator McCain and I have worked on several bills together as it relates to Russia, including the Magnitsky bill. So I share a lot of his concerns. But you asked the right follow-up question. One thing we don't want this administration to do is give provocation for military conflict that we saw happen in Georgia that really changed the equation in that country, where we are still fighting to get back the legitimate territory of Georgia that's controlled by Russia. So we don't want to see provocative actions that would lead to military conflict. What we do want to do is have Russia pay a very heavy price if they continue down this path, so that they know not to do this, and we hopefully will get them to change their attitude. And I think Senator McCain is expressing frustration in other parts of Europe where we have seen Russian aggression. It's absolutely true. Mr. Putin is leading Russia in a very dangerous way. I don't think it represents the future for Russia, and we hope that we'll see a change. We've seen that happen in many countries, including in Ukraine, where their leader was corrupt, and the people demanded a different leader and got a different leader.
Does this all come down to personality of one man? Is that why our relations with Russia are so bad? Or is it there are just a lot of resentment throughout Russia for the United States still? Has President Obama made any progress in that regard with anyone other than President Putin? Or can't you get past President Putin? Is this all about this one man's and his personality, this old cold warrior? Max, what do you think?
Well, Russia is Putin, and Putin believes he's Russia, so he's an absolute leader. He has control over the judiciary, the legislative branch, the executive branch, and of course, we saw how he orchestrated his succession from becoming prime minister and making Medvedev the president. So the opposition has limited voice in Russia. If Putin wants to detain you, he detains you. If he wants the court to convict you, the court convicts you. And so Russia is Putin. How do we go past this? Because, I mean, clearly, Putin is still wrapped in the Cold War era. He sees politics as zero sum or foreign policy. And I think he's acting on fear or on the misperception of what the actions of the West are. I mean, if you compare Ukraine to Czech Republic, Slovakia, Poland, they have a much higher standard of living than Ukraine or any of the countries in the Russian sphere. And there are 6 million Ukrainian migrant workers in these various countries. They see the standard of living of people in the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Poland has escalated, whereas theirs have deteriorated. So I think basically the actions in Ukraine is for a better life, not to get caught up in this geopolitics between East and West.
Yeah. Senator, this is a tough one. It does come down to Putin.
You're right, but I think I agree that Russia is Putin right now, and Putin came in to fill a void. The void was that Russia was seen by its own population as being of diminished importance globally, and they wanted Russia restored to its previous respect. And Mr. Putin built on that nationalism and built it into a very dangerous nationalist policies. And it was popular with the people of Russia. I think it's no longer as popular as it was before because of his oppressive actions on human rights and because of his totally being outside the scope of international norm, and the fact that his government has a significant amount of corruption involved in it. And the people of Russia are now recognizing that, yes, they wanted a leader that would return the respect to Russia, but they did not want a person who would be out of step with international norms. So I think his popularity is diminished, but clearly the policies of Russia reflect Mr. Putin. Mr. Medvedev was unable to counter that during his term as a leader. He was secondary to Mr. Putin at all times, and this reflects a leader who has the old-style Russian training, who will use any means, is not straightforward with his own people, and will do anything in order to accomplish what he believes is right.
Senator, before you leave us, let's take one call from our listeners here. This is Kevin with a question for our guests, Senator Cardin and Max Hilaire. Go right ahead, Kevin.
Yes, this is kind of a general question to everyone, but Putin obviously has a narrative that he's trying to spin to defend this, that this is to defend Russian ethnics in Crimea. And there's some hesitation on the European community, it seems, to apply sanctions. And I'm wondering if any of that is related to, is anyone buying his story? Obviously, here in America, it seems like an evasion. And Merkel was willing to kind of take his story on face value and say, we'll send in forces to see if there is any oppression of Russians in Crimea. But is there really, in terms of the international community, what's the delay in terms of sanctions? Why are other countries hesitant?
Well, let me try to respond first. I think there's always a hesitation on imposing particular sanctions because you're concerned that there will be individual companies in your country or individuals who may be adversely affected. It's something you don't want to do. But having said that, I think the options are limited as to what you can do. There is no disagreement at all that the Russian ethnic population in Crimea are not under attack. There's been no harm at all shown. In fact, the Ukrainian parliament and the government is all-inclusive, so that you have a government that has reached out to say, we want all ethnic communities involved in the government, and there's been no action at all taken to infringe upon the independence. There's been statements made that we're going to protect the Russian-speaking, the ability to use their language, et cetera, et cetera. So if anything, it's been the reverse. And the international community is prepared to send in independent observers to make sure that, in fact, is the case. And today, representatives of the OSCE, which is responsible for this, are in Crimea or on their way to Crimea in order to carry that out to show that there is no need for what Russia is claiming they have to do. But I think the reluctancy is not because of the action of Russia. It's just the more unity, if we can show unity, then I think the imposition of penalties will be more accepted. But once you see some countries do it and others not, you think you might adversely affect some of your commercial interests in your own country.
Well, I also think the president is being very careful how he approached this issue, and giving diplomacy a chance is always the best option. There's no military option available at this point for the United States or for NATO. And as Senator Cardin just indicated, we do not want to provoke any more violence in that region. The people of Ukraine are not looking for violence. They have lost about 80 to 90 people, and basically they're looking to get back to their lives and an improvement in their living conditions. And if that can be done without the use of force, I think it's the best for Ukraine, for Europe, and for the United States. So the rush to sanctions is not going to force Putin to back down. And I think what Secretary Kerry is doing, working with our European allies, trying to engage the Russians, is the best approach at this time.
Thank you, Max. And thank you, Senator Cardin, for your time today.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Talk to you all soon.
Yep. Senator Ben Cardin speaking to us from Washington. Max Hilaire is with us for the remainder of this hour. We'll take some more phone calls. Open lines here on Midday. You can reach us at 410-662-8780 with your opinion about how President Obama is handling this situation. What do you make of Putin? Should we just leave him alone there to occupy Crimea? Should the U.S. and European nations force Putin to pull his troops from the Crimean Peninsula or accept the occupation as a way of keeping Russia from advancing further into Ukraine? And is that a real threat? 410-662-8780. Our toll-free long-distance number, good from anywhere in the country, 866-661-9309. We'd like to hear from you. Our Midday email address, midday@wypr.org. And our number, 410-662-8780. So, Max, I just want to go over something here with you so we understand all this, right? Ukraine wanted to be part of the European Union. A lot of people there wanted to see that happen. It didn't happen. The former president, Viktor Yanukovych, was against that. He was against that, it seems like, because Putin was against that, right?
Well, basically, Ukraine was about to sign an agreement with the European Union, which would be sort of a first step in terms of a closer relationship and ultimately joining the EU. Moldova did sign that agreement. Ukraine backed off after Yanukovych gave people the impression that he would sign the agreement.
Right,
so it was a last-minute pulling off, and then he goes ahead, sign this agreement with Russia that ultimately would have taken Ukraine into this Eurasia group Putin is forming as an alternative to the European Union.
Right.
So that's where it is. But the people in Ukraine realize that their situation has been deteriorating for a long time, and getting closer into the Russian sphere is not a solution to the economic problem.
So we had protests.
And we had the protests.
And Yanukovych decided to leave the country.
He left the country. And hence Putin decided, well, it was Russia's opportunity to take a stand to prevent Ukraine from going full-fledged into the Western camp.
And
this is where we are.
Okay, so that's what you think he's doing.
Well, basically, that's what he would like, a commitment from the West that Ukraine will not be a member of NATO, and Ukraine probably he would accept some kind of partnership with the European Union, but not full-fledged membership that would allow for the European border to be drawn closer to Russia than what it is now.
Okay, well, Ukraine's... so now we're getting somewhere. Now, this may be what he's negotiating for, those kinds of agreements.
Well, I think that's what he's looking for.
But is that realistic, given the feelings of people in Ukraine?
Well, I think...
And the new government in Ukraine.
I think they...
Pro-Western government.
The pro-Western... But the people, the governments in Europe, particularly Germany, which has a lot of clout in the European Union, is probably willing to reach some kind of compromise in which both Russia and the West can be satisfied with an outcome to this Ukrainian crisis. How do you prevent particularly the young population of Ukraine from wanting to travel, from wanting that the protections that they see the people in? Because as I indicated before, there are 6 million migrant Ukrainians doing menial work, whether it's construction, restaurant, hotel work in the Czech Republic, in Slovakia, Hungary, and Poland. They go back and forth. They realize the difference between the lifestyle styles in these countries that join the EU and theirs. And I think basically what they're looking for is some improvement in their well-being and the ability to travel freely in Europe, which they don't enjoy now.
So when you pull this all apart, it's Putin not wanting Ukraine to go to the West. He resents that Ukraine isn't part of Russia, number one, right? He didn't like the breakup of the Soviet Union, this old KGB guy, right? We know that. So he just doesn't want to see that Western lean in Ukraine. He doesn't want to lose Ukraine, so
well,
to speak.
Well, he doesn't, but keep in mind, even during the Soviet Union, Ukraine and Belarus both had seats in the General Assembly at the United Nations as semi-independent countries.
Even during the Soviet Union,
During the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. That was the agreement reached with President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill that Russia would have these two additional seats in the General Assembly. So Ukraine has enjoyed some degree of autonomy from Russia, even while it was part of the Soviet Union, because they had a separate vote in the General Assembly, whether it was symbolic or it was just to give the Russians an added vote. But that is what diplomacy is all about. That's what international politics is all about. We reach compromise. There are winners and losers. But at the end of the day, if we could prevent conflict, and that was technically intended to get Russia committed to the United Nations, and it worked.
Let's take some calls. 410-662-8780, the phone number for Midday here on WYPR. Britt in White Marsh, we'll go to you. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me on. I run a blog, and I've been following, I'm a historian, a sociologist. I've been following this situation for like 15 years. And ever since the Soviet Union went down, about 18 months after that happened, we, the West, particularly the United States, started to push against the periphery of Russia. As you've talked about before, in Georgia, We tried to get them in NATO, 2,000 miles from the Atlantic Ocean. We tried the same thing in Romania. We're always pushing against it. Now, Ukraine was basically founded as a buffer state. And we knew that it was going to be divided in half, and the idea is to act like a buffer, a car bumper, between these two giants, which, by the way, have been at war for 747 years. This is a continuing, constant battle. And I think one of the mistakes we're making is we keep trying to put personalities into it. This is Putin doing this, Putin doing that. It's not. It's a normal action against a reaction. And the thing is, the United States and outsiders that get involved make these things far worse. We have no business being along the Dnieper River or the Danube. We have no business there.
Max.
Well, I would disagree. I spend a tremendous amount of time in Central Europe. I have seen the transformation of the former Soviet bloc. I've been going to the region since 1990. I do believe the people in Ukraine are basically looking for something different from what exists. And frankly, I do not believe this bipolar world that existed during the Cold War is still something we can clinch to. Yes, Putin wants to hold on to it. But with technology, with globalization, this whole framework in which we used to see the world is no longer valid. And hence, we have a global community. You are either part of it or you opt out of it. And if you opt out, you're worse off than if you're part of the global community. We also need a rule of law system in the international community that all people could live by. So it's not a world of states, it's a world of peoples. And I think the Ukrainian people feel left out of the global community, which is what they're fighting for at this point.
Let's go to Annapolis for a call from Noel. And welcome, Noel, to Midday. Hi.
Hi, Dan. Yeah, I just wanted to comment exactly on what your guest was just saying, is particularly with the example of Georgia. I think, you know, the previous caller was sort of thinking that we have to relegate people to either being part of Russia or being part of the European Union. But rather, what it seems to me is exactly what you're saying, that people want something different. And, you know, Georgia is a perfect example. It's a culture that is only recently influenced by Russia, was living under the Soviet Union, has a very unique culture and all these kinds of things. And I just wanted to make comment, ask the question, if your person also thought that the way that I feel is that the sort of U.S. policy, sort of wishy-washy policy towards NATO membership for Georgia, making all these conditions, and, of course, the failure of, you know, I'm part of Mikhail Saakashvili in 2008, has, you know, been a major contributor to the fact of how things have gone in Ukraine. We sort of promised them NATO membership, but here we have Georgia, who's transitioned to a new power very peacefully, basically has two cold conflicts, and the U.S. keeps saying that, you know, we want them to join NATO, but in their most recent statement, they're not really supporting it. They just say, we're happy to support the efforts of Georgia to seek its own membership in NATO, instead of sort of being forceful and, you know, just being really committed to not be a dichotomy world, you know, that it's NATO versus Russia, but rather that it's the will of the Georgian people or the will of the Ukrainian people to join this global community, and they need stability and security to do that.
All right, now let's hear from Max Hilaire on that.
Well, I would be one of them who would think we miss an opportunity to dismantle NATO or reconfigure NATO into a European security architecture in the post-Cold War. That idea was brought about by President Gorbachev at the end of the Cold War. It was the United States rejected it, and some of it saw the NATO member states. But I think it's not a question of bringing in Ukraine and Georgia into NATO. I think what is needed in Europe, because certainly we do not need a sort of a Cold War alliance, military alliance in Europe, because even as is now, there is not much deterrence NATO can provide for Ukraine or Georgia or anyone else. So because the cost of war is just too high between the Russia and Europe or the United Soviet state. So I think what we need to is go post the post-Cold War and think of a new security architecture in Europe, whether we enhance the security role of the OSCE or we create a new organization that would include Russia, Georgia, Ukraine, and all EU member states. Because I personally think the last thing the people in the EU want is a war between NATO and Russia.
Here's Teresa in Baltimore with a question for our guest, Max Hilaire. Hi, Teresa.
Yes, hi, Dan. Thank you for taking my call. And I have two questions. I'll take the answers off the air and then one comment. My questions are, I heard that there were going to be elections in the Ukraine in May, and I'm wondering if we can speculate, and it is just speculation, why these people didn't wait until May to change their government in a legal, non-chaotic fashion. And secondly, I also understand that the Crimea is an autonomous republic, and it seems to me that legally they might have the right to call in the Russians if they feel for any reason that they need aid, if they felt their population was under threat. Mr. Cardin says they're not, but, you know, I don't know if that's true or not. And my comment is, I am not one of these Americans that believe everything that comes out of my government. And right now, what I see coming out of the government and the rhetoric looks like a clown show to me, and most of the clowns seem to be in our own government. Listening to John McCain now, John McCain sounds like a foaming at the mouth warmonger.
Because I thought if you were talking about President Obama or Secretary of State Kerry.
As far as I'm concerned, most of them are saying things that I'd like to know where the adults are. That's where I really...
Well, I don't know. Please.
Well, for the first question, the elections were in the initial agreement signed between Yanukovych and the U.S., the EU, with Russia having an observer, had agreed for the elections to be held in December. The people on the street disagreed. In fact, when members of the opposition who participated in the negotiations of that interim agreement went back to the square to address people, they were booed. So the opposition did not have any grounds to stand on because the people on the street refused to accept the agreement to go along with a December election because Yanukovych had become so unpopular and so corrupt that people were not willing to wait. They have agreed to an election in May. You have an interim government that is all-inclusive, and that is what will happen. The issue in Crimea is autonomous within the Republic of Ukraine. It does not have the authority to call in external forces into the territory.
Okay, it is part of Ukraine.
It is the
Autonomous Republic of Crimea in Ukraine.
But it does not have any external authority or authority under international law to invite foreign troops on its territory.
And there's no evidence that they did.
And there's no evidence that they did.
I mean, it's mostly the pretext offered by Putin that he's there to protect Russian-speaking people of Crimea. Just comes from him.
Yeah, if we were to accept that, then it gives Putin the right to do so in Estonia, in Lithuania, in Latvia, and even in Czech Republic, where you have a sizable Russian migrant population.
I caught a video clip on television a couple of nights ago of Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of New York City and the presidential candidate, complaining that President Obama hadn't acted decisively in this or any other crisis, according to Giuliani. And then he compared him to Putin. He said, you know, when Putin wants to do something, he decides to do it, and he does it. Our president hems and haws and thinks about it. But I was thinking, well, this is the difference between the president of a democracy and a dictator, is it not?
That's precisely what it is. Okay. The president is...
thank you, Rudy. This is a comment from Frank in Hampstead and Carroll County. He says, I believe that the president's handling of the Ukraine situation is measured and considered. No thinking from his gut here. You would want a careful response since a misstep could send the situation out of control.
And I think that's quite accurate. The president needs to be very careful, needs to think this thing through. And of course, we still have important interests that we want to preserve with Russia, whether it's continuing to dismantle some of its nuclear weapons, relations with Iran, with Syria, whatever. So the president is I think, being very careful and has the right approach.
Max Hilaire, associate professor and chairman of the political science department at Morgan State University, joins us from time to time to talk about national and international affairs. Thank you, Max.
You're welcome, Dan.
And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to our first hour of midday. We're going to take a brunch today. I'm going to take a break today and have lunch because brunch would only be up until noon. So once we get to noon, it actually becomes lunch. And it's brought to us today by Bagby Pizza Company, located in Baltimore's historic Bagby Building in Harbor East. Bagby Pizza Company serving up brick oven, thin crust pizza, gourmet sandwiches, pasta, salads, and more. Thank you, Bagby's.